Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Homegrown leads into Sunday morning wake-up call. That makes for a blissful, blessed Sunday morning. It's a beautiful Sunday morning, and hopefully we can just continue with that from inside to outside here at WPVC. Today we will be talking politics. Doesn't that make for bliss and bless? Our friend today, Bob Gibson, joins us. Now, Bob, I believe we promoted that as from the Center for Politics.
Not exactly.
Not exactly. It's the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service, where you are the communications director.
Yes, and have been there for about 10 years, eight of which with the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership.
How is the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service tied to UVA?
Well, we're a part of UVA. We're the part of UVA that assists communities and governments, local governments, state government across Virginia. So we have six or seven various components of the Cooper Center, including the demographics research group and survey research, different groups that assist local government all over Virginia and assist the state government with everything from population projections to political leadership and training.
Now, as the communications director, when I ask you a question today throughout the hour, are you just going to give me some answer back that has been beautifully typed up and is just some statement that
Rick, you know me better than that.
You're allowed to give back?
The fact that I work at UVA is not really part of the show. I mean, I'm someone who for 35 years covered politics and government.
Goes all the way back to writing articles for the Daily Progress.
Right, and WCHV news director before that, and host of a weekly talk show on politics for many years, and then a monthly talk show on politics on public radio in Roanoke for many years. So my affiliation with the UVA, I'm not speaking for the university is what I'm saying.
Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Let's start with, we're going to cover a lot of things today. I want everybody to stick with us throughout the hour. We're going to talk about what happened back in November, the November elections here at the state of Virginia, the tsunami election, as it was tagged. We're going to talk about redistricting and gerrymandering. I want to talk a little bit about the recounts. There was an article that just came out recently about fake news that you were a part of. So throughout the hour, we're going to jump in and out of a lot of that. So I want the listeners to stay with us here on 94.7 as we talk with Bob Gibson from the Weldon Cooper Center. But let's start with what happened at the Virginia elections back in November. The Democrats sweep the top three state seats. They flip 15 House seats, at least so far, because, as I mentioned, there will be a couple recounts that, as of now, belong to Republicans. The House of Delegates goes from 66-34 Republicans, if my numbers are correct, to 51-49.
And that could change. There are now three recounts that are being considered that are going forward in the next couple of weeks. So it's possible that could change, although people don't expect a recount to change an election result. It could happen.
But one of them is just 10 votes apart. I mean, if something's going to change in a recount, you would think that one might happen.
I think that may be the most likely, and ironically, that delegate seat in Newport News is held by a Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership graduate alumnus of the University of Virginia, who is 10 votes behind right now before the recount is also a Sorensen alum. There are lots of people with lots of ties to UVA in these races all across Virginia.
Is this something that people always look at this and they say, you know, as the Virginia elections are coming up, for many years now, the Virginia election is the predictor of what's going to happen the following year, right?
Sometimes. I mean, it depends on whether the people are seeing it as more likely that Virginia is predicting something for 2018.
I have a quote here from The Hill, which is an online, would you call it a newspaper?
It has been a newspaper. It's a publication in Washington that covers Capitol, yeah.
Far too much is made of the alleged brilliance of Donald Trump in hyper-motivating what is called his base. To the degree that Trump succeeded in hyper-motivating the 37% who approved him, to an even greater degree in the 2017 elections, he hyper-motivated the 58% who disapprove him.
Well, that's very much a part of what happened last month across Virginia. There are two factors that are making Virginia bluer in terms of its political partisan leanings right now. One is demographics, and that is continuing year after year. As more people move into Virginia, especially into Northern Virginia, it becomes a more Democratic state. And the counties that are voting more Republican are in the rural parts of the state. Some of them are losing population and becoming older in their makeup. Fewer younger voters, fewer younger workers, fewer students hanging around because there are fewer jobs in many of these counties. They're moving to suburbia and urban settings in Virginia, many of them. And those are the areas that are becoming more Democratic. So there's the demographics of change that are pushing the state a little more blue. And then there's Trump, which is pushing the state a lot more blue because the state is reacting to our president's behavior in office and showing its resistance to that.
So here we have an election, not even quite a month ago, that turns 15 House seats from Republican to Democrat.
Right, red to blue.
We have Democrats win the top three, all three seats, governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general.
By significant margins, 9 percentage points for Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, our governor-elect, yes.
The one of the most open social conservative candidates, Republican social candidates, loses, surprisingly.
Bob Marshall. Well, he's part of the Northern Virginia Republican delegation that has been shrinking year after year. Every 2 years they have House of Delegates elections in Northern Virginia. Every 2 years there are fewer Republicans returned to Richmond. And Bob Marshall became a victim this year.
But was that predicted? I mean, when people went into that, you're talking about he lost to the transgender candidate Danica Rome. I think I'm pronouncing her name properly.
That's right. She's a former reporter and a longtime and very respected journalist in that area.
She chose to run her race not talking about social topic. She didn't run about how transgender individuals need to be treated better, about how gay marriages need to be allowed and not treated. You know, bakers need to be forced to sell cakes to all marriages, not just the ones they approve of.
No, she ran on local issues. She ran on transportation. She ran on congestion on highways. She ran specifically on Route 28, which is a major choke point of people who drive in Prince William County. and how the state has to do a better job in fixing those transportation problems.
And Bob Marshall chose not to, well, first he chose not to even have a debate, which in some cases isn't even unusual for someone who's running again. But he wouldn't even talk about her.
He wouldn't refer to her as her. He wouldn't use her gender. So I think people saw that he was being rigid and ideological, and she was being someone who was addressing local issues.
So how surprising to you, and you representing the media and the voting public in general, how surprising was it that he lost?
Not terribly surprising, given that it was a wave election. I think Bob Marshall has held on for more than 20 years as a member of the House of Delegates, largely through his efforts to work for constituents and to appeal to conservatives and Christians who like his brand of social politics. But that minority in his district has been getting smaller every year as the district has changed, as Northern Virginia has become bluer. And the trends over the years show that a strong candidate, and Danica Rum was a strong candidate, is one, could beat him. And it's nearly happened before, so in a wave election, it finally happened.
But when you say that, not surprising in a wave election, that's looking at it in the past. Would you have predicted that the day before the election?
I would have thought it close.
Okay. Here we are again, folks, talking with Bob Gibson, Communications Director at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. It's been a long time since you've been on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thanks again.
No, thank you.
For being here.
Thanks for inviting me. Do you take calls?
We can, and we don't as much on this show anymore, but I'd love to have a call if someone would love to call in. 284-9470. 434-284-9470. You're welcome to call in if you'd like to talk with Bob Gibson. One of the other or another segment of the wave election, 10 new women voted in. I feel like that shouldn't be surprising today, but...
Well, Virginia was behind in that category. We were among the bottom third of states electing women to state offices, and I think the state is catching up this year by electing 10 or 11 new women to the House of Delegates. There were no women who lost, who ran as Republicans or Democrats as incumbents. Only men lost as incumbents. So I think Virginia is finally sort of entering the more national trend. We're more like the nation every year in terms of our vote.
And if my memory is correct, did we aside from Danica Rome as transgender, we also had openly gay candidates who won their elections as well?
Yes, and that again shows that Virginia is becoming more like the rest of the nation.
But weren't we, or were we not, ahead of several other southern states? I mean, we always talk about, or you hear this in the national news, about how when you look across the country, right, they put up that map of red and blue, and there are way more red states. Obviously, we're not talking about numbers. We're not talking about individual numbers of voters. We're just talking about that electoral map. Virginia, for the last three or four presidential elections, has been blue.
It has, and Virginia as a map looks fairly red, but cows don't vote. where the people are, people vote. And those people tend to be concentrated in the suburbs and the urban areas increasingly. And in addition to the changing demographics of Virginia and the Trump factor, which is weighing in the Democrats' favor right now, although that, who knows how long that wave is going to roll, we have Virginia also trending toward the nation in terms of elections where urban areas and suburban areas with high college graduate levels are voting more demographic, and rural areas with lower college graduate populations are trending to vote more Republican. So that is one of the key indicators of whether an area is going to vote Democratic or Republican. The more college graduates there are in the area, the more likely it is to vote, to trend to be more Democratic.
Is that why Virginia, I can't think of the phrase, I think of the word arc, that goes from Northern Virginia and swings through Richmond and Charlottesville and then down.
Yeah, the Golden Crescent.
The Golden Crescent.
Is the population density area that basically touches the interstates, 64 and 95. Any county or city that's on 64 or 95 from Charlottesville to Norfolk and Virginia Beach and from Arlington in the north to Richmond and below now in the south, those are the most trending Democratic localities. Those are the localities that are doing better economically. Those are the localities that are attracting more people. It's the areas outside the urban and suburban parts of Virginia that are losing population largely or becoming older in their population, as young folks don't necessarily want to stay around because they don't have the job opportunities in those rural areas that perhaps they once might have had.
Sunday morning wake-up call, speaking with Bob Gibson from the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. Bob, is there a concern? I think about how back in, I want to say 2008, Tom Perriello gets elected, the year that President Obama takes office, and there's that sort of wave. And then 2 years later, there's the opposite when the Tea Party comes in and Tom Perriello gets voted out. Is there a concern for this year's legislative victory for the Democrats that they need to be concerned about and wary that something similar may happen to them 2 years from now if Governor-elect Northam doesn't make people happy, if the if things don't swing their way?
Certainly. There's no resting on laurels in politics anymore. Change is happening faster and faster in our political life today than it used to. So what is a wave election this year and perhaps next year can very easily turn around in a few years.
All right, 20 minutes after the hour, we're going to take our first break. We'll be right back. You're welcome to call in with a question if you have one for Bob Gibson. It's not always available. Take advantage while you can. And here we are back on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. A beautiful Sunday inside and outside the radio station. Thanks for being here with us today. We're talking with Bob Gibson. He's the communications director at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. And we're talking about what happened at the Virginia elections back in November of 2017, taking advantage of the knowledge that we have across the table from us with Bob Gibson. You know, Bob, one of the things I'm curious about, and this works not just about what happened in November, but it can apply to so many different things. That politicians make their decisions upon the tax bill that recently passed, decisions that will be made tomorrow, decisions that were made a month ago, who's going to win the next party election. Polling. Not believing the polls that are presented to you today, the poll that's put right in front of you, it seems that polls are no longer believed or trusted.
Well, there's a lot to say about that. Polling is becoming more difficult in the technologies that people are using today.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, people don't answer their phones. And those who get back to a pollster who has left a message on a phone are a self-selecting audience. They're no longer a random sample. So people who dodge polls or do not answer fully or do not answer honestly is becoming a problem. And many people don't have landlines anymore. They have cell phones, and people are more difficult to reach on cell phones. They don't return calls on cell phones necessarily unless they know who they're calling. So if you get a number that you don't recognize, many people won't call it back, and I don't blame them. So polling is becoming a much more difficult, especially as the internet is now involved, and some of the samples involve reaching people through email and internet as opposed to on the phone.
So when you hear a news story, no matter where it's from, anything from NPR to, I don't use this phrase because we're going to use it again, whether I hear the news from on NPR or, you know, fake news radio, and they say, oh, today's poll says Rick Moore is going to be the next president. Sorry, Bob Gibson, for your wonderful race, but you're going down like a wet balloon. You shouldn't believe that. Because
polls are often misreported. Polls are not a predictive factor. Polls are a snapshot in time looking backwards to when they were conducted. Rather than predicting what's going to happen in a week or a month or a year, polls are a look back at last week or last 10 days. And things change, and they're changing faster. So polls are not meant to be predictive, yet they're used as horse race indicators and somehow given great power as predictors, but they don't deserve that power.
A lot of that seems, though, am I wrong in saying that the polls really took a big hit in validity November of 2016 when everyone, all the polls were saying that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president and Donald Trump won the election?
Of course they took a hit. And Hillary Clinton was elected in terms of the popular vote, but that's not what determined the presidency. So the fact that the polls were accurate and that they predicted a several million vote win for Hillary Clinton, many of them, was contradicted by the actual numbers in the Electoral College, where several states that were not expected to go for Trump went for Trump at the last minute, perhaps because he ran a good campaign, perhaps because she did not run a good campaign. There are many factors involved, including fake news and Russian involvement in fake news and other fake news that was instituted across Eastern Europe as teenagers decided they could make some money by putting up clickbait fake news. And there's a town in Macedonia, just north of Greece, where the average teenager earned something like $20,000 or more dollars making fake news stories to put on Twitter, to put on Facebook, to put on other social media outlets. And they knew enough about American politics to make them attractive to people so that people would click on them. And some people believed this stuff that was just made up in Macedonia.
Well, let's talk about that. An article that you recently a part of, writing and editing, the spread of fake news. I copied this little bit from it. 20 top performing false election stories from hoax sites generated 8.7 million comments, reactions from Facebook. 8.7 million from the top 20 false stories, while the 20 best true stories only got 7.3.
Americans were clicking on what appealed to them, not based on fact, but based on the clickbait that was being tossed out. One of the stories that got the most clicks was the Pope endorsing Donald Trump for president. Of course, anyone who is very up on politics or even very up on the church would know that's not possible. But many Americans clicked on that, and some apparently believed it.
But wouldn't you, I mean, just if that's a topic, or, I mean, a headline, I might click on it just to read it and then go, that's false. I had to stop and...
False is a good word, yeah.
And but I would become one of the 8.7 million...
Or, I'm not saying everybody believed it. I'm just saying that there were more false news stories out there on the internet that people were clicking on than true news stories. So how informed was the American electorate?
What would the... or was it better headlines?
Well, clickbait includes getting people interested to click on a story. So those who were writing fake news stories put more intriguing headlines on them, and that generates more clicks sometimes.
Does the phrase fake news, does that come with President Trump?
Well, the president has turned it around to try to take the regular mainstream media outlets, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, and to basically get people to doubt their stories, which are more credible and better researched, and to trust the stories that he prefers they trust,
right,
that would deny any involvement with Russia, for example. When I think he's the last person in Washington who thinks there was no involvement with his campaign and the Russians.
This is 94.7 WPVC. Our guest today, Bob Gibson from the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. You're welcome to call and take advantage of today's topic as we talk about the outcome from the 2017 Virginia's elections. We're also talking about a little bit about fake news here. Hang tight. We're going to get into gerrymandering and redistricting as well. Bob, give me, what else did you find out with this article on fake news? I mean, that's a lot. 8.7 million for the top 20 false news stories versus 7.3 million of the 20 best true stories.
People have to be better consumers and understand what they're clicking on and what they're looking at and the sources of news. If you're a casual consumer of news and you believe everything you see on your Facebook feed, you're forgetting that Facebook is using algorithms that basically give you what you want and what you've clicked on before. So if you click on 10 fake news stories, you're going to get 100 more fake news stories because that's what Facebook is designed to send you.
Is Facebook have any at fault in any of this?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes, and so is Twitter and the large American corporate media interests that have basically said we are just there to allow free discussion have neglected their responsibility to police the airwaves and the internet so that campaigns can be fairly understood in terms of who's paying for what and who is providing what information. We used to have very strong laws on that said if you're making a campaign contribution, the individual making the donation has to be listed and the amount has to be listed, and people can judge where campaign contributions and their messages are coming from. But that is rapidly changing in our political atmosphere today, and now much of the news that we're getting and much of the money that's going into politics is from people who are not showing where it's really coming from. So it makes it much more difficult for the consumer. And the consumer has to become a better educated consumer of news and understand that if you don't know the source, chances are you're playing with something that may not be true. If you do know the source, you have to trust which sources are going to vet and properly present both sides of a story or many sides of a story, and which sources are just out there to provide entertainment or provide ideological fodder.
You mentioned that many, or mentioned at least some of these fake news stories came from Macedonia. Did, of these top 20 stories, were they coming from 20 different news sites? Were they coming from one different, all coming from one site?
Well, we're learning more and more about what the Russians were doing. We don't know the total scope of their involvement yet, but they have college students who are basically trained in studying American politics and providing false news to disrupt American politics. So they will take stories that they know from reading the American news media, and they'll twist them and turn them around and start talking about race war and start talking about problems that we have in our society in ways that perhaps are intended to disrupt our elections.
Has it gotten down, excuse me, has it gotten to the state level yet?
Yes. Many states have had their election bureaus, their state election officials, official sites, and even local sites hacked.
I noticed that when I voted this year, I had a different voting machine, and I think part of that was because didn't they determine sometime over the spring or summer that Virginia machines could be hacked? Not that they had been hacked.
There was a possibility
of
that.
Could be, and so they had to change the machines?
There's now a paper record. Everybody has a paper record of their vote, so that if there is a hacking and that is determined to be a problem, then you can go back and look at the intended vote.
So I had a different machine, a different method of voting, and so while there's no record that we had been hacked in the past, that was all related to
the insecurity we have because of our vulnerability to hacking, which is widespread.
Right. Again, Bob Gibson here, Communications Director at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service, and once again, tell everybody your vast past history and all the politics that you've been involved with, all the political reporting.
Well, you're pointing out that I'm old. But I started as a reporter in the early 70s.
It's history. 70s. Take advantage of the deep history that you have.
I worked for 34 years as a Charlottesville reporter, for 32 of those years at the Daily Progress, covering police, courts, politics, local government, state politics. Then part of that time as city editor and special projects editor, and have been writing a monthly, since I left 10 years ago, monthly column for the Daily Progress and the Roanoke Times, and before that 10-year period, a weekly column for many years.
Well, I can't help. You started when you were 8. That's pretty good.
Thank you.
So let's talk for a little bit about gerrymandering and redistricting. It is 35 minutes after the hour. I want to make sure that we get this included in our conversation today. The Republicans gained control of the Virginia legislature quite some time ago.
18 years ago, about.
And so through redistricting, the polite way to put it, they got to redraw the map of how the districts were laid out.
For both congressional districts and for state legislative districts, the House of Delegates and the state Senate. Now, the state Senate part of that time was controlled by Democrats, so they did the gerrymandering in their state Senate election districts, and the Republicans over the last two times have done the gerrymandering, which has been quite helpful to them in the House of Delegates elections in the House districts across Virginia. There are 100 of those, and they're actually easier to gerrymander because they are smaller.
So it's gone on for decades.
Oh, many decades. Democrats used to do it.
We can't blame, even though WPVC is the progressive voice of Charlottesville, we can't just go back to the last two to census.
Democrats have done this for many times before that. Yeah, both sides are equally culpable of gerrymandering, and both sides have resisted reform. Right now, there's a greater movement for reform to end gerrymandering, to get the final decision or the drawing of the lines away from the people who are choosing their own voters and into the hands of a commission that would not be using incumbency as and partisanship as the primary motivation for drawing districts.
But whoever is in control at the time, currently the Republicans, say that whoever you give the power for that to, that's always going to be, whoever's doing it is always going to have, always going to want to vote for somebody.
So you want to have criteria.
They're never going to be nonpartisan.
Well, and it's difficult to find total nonpartisans. You've got to find a nunnery or a cloister somewhere. But that's not the problem. The problem is the criteria. And the criteria that have been used allow partisan gerrymandering to be the top criterion for drawing a district. The state constitution says that districts must be compact, contiguous, and reflect communities of interest. And that isn't always the case because partisanship is more often applied as an overlay to that map. So if partisanship were banned as a criterion, then there would be a chance to draw districts that would make sense to voters. Right now, the district lines are so whacked that there is a district, there are two House districts in the Fredericksburg area where people, hundreds of people, were given the wrong ballots because we had split precincts in those House districts, and the people running the election didn't know which ballot to give to the voters. So hundreds of people were denied the chance to vote in their own district because the elections officials were even confused as to which district they were in.
One of the possible recounts, it's, I guess Democrats have yet to...
Well, they're not going to recount in that one. They're probably going straight to court.
Right. Again, our guest today, Bob Gibson from the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. As we talk about gerrymandering, I saw a book title and I failed to write down the author. Redistricting, the most political activity in America. And that made me chuckle for a minute. It's incredibly difficult to do properly unless you just say, draw a circle, draw a square, put the proper number of people in it, and then draw another one next to it, or below it, or above it, and move on.
It's possible to draw fair districts. It's possible to draw districts that are not skewed for one party's advantage. And I think Virginia will get there, but it's going to take a real push from the public. Our governor-elect, Ralph Northam, has promised not to sign a gerrymander bill, so there's going to be pressure on the legislature this time that there hasn't been before to get away from gerrymandering and to draw districts that do not put partisanship at the top.
All right. More to discuss on gerrymandering and redistricting. We'll be right back with Bob Gibson. All right. Back with Bob Gibson. Bob, one of the things as we continue to talk about gerrymandering, I read this. I believe this is also in on the Hill that I read was... The Supreme Court dismissed a Republican challenge to redistricting in Virginia. In their appeal, Rob Whitman, Randy Forbes, and David Bratt argued that in the remedy for the unconstitutional 2012 plan, a portion of their electorate was replaced with Democrats, reducing the likelihood that they'll win the election, that they'll win re-election. And that made me laugh because these Republicans, Mr. Whitman, Forbes, and David Bratt, were arguing that to fix the problem that the Supreme Court said was a problem, they needed to bring these people back, right? You have a district that the Supreme Court said is unfair. You have too many Republicans in yours, Mr. Forbes. You drew it unfairly. You put too many Republicans in yours so you'd win. So you put too many Democrats in the other one.
Well, they were using the Voting Rights Act and the protection of a black majority district to say that they were fairly redistricting by giving lots of Virginia minority voters to the third district of Bobby Scott. And Bobby Scott's district ran up and down the James River, crossing it several times, and was clearly a partisan gerrymandered district. But they could get away with that because they were able to say, well, look, we're using the Voting Rights Act and we're protecting the minority vote interest in that district. And the courts said, sorry, you packed too many black voters into one district. There's no excuse for that. You've got to redraw that part of the state. And when they did, they elected a second black congressman from Virginia. So the courts have stood up to some of the most blatant uses of gerrymandering, and that may happen again. The Supreme Court is considering a Wisconsin case right now. It will rule sometime by June. There is a case percolating through the Virginia Supreme Court that also challenges racial gerrymandering in 11 districts in the House of Delegates and State Senate. And that may call for new elections and a court-ordered, perhaps a third of the districts in the eastern and central part of Virginia may have to change.
Yeah, the Wisconsin case, and I don't know that Virginia is that much different. In Wisconsin, the Republicans won 48.6 of the statewide vote, but 60 of the 99 assembly seats. I mean, that, to me, is a prime example of gerrymandering, right?
Oh, we saw that in Virginia this year. Last month, Democrats in House elections won many more votes than Republicans in House elections, and yet the Republican majority was maintained slightly, apparently. It's right now 51-49, as you pointed out. Very easily could become 50-50 if we have a change through one of the recounts. But if the wave election fairly represented was represented in all of the districts in Virginia, the Democrats might have had a majority by now in the House of Delegates.
By the way, David Toscano will be on the Sunday morning wake-up call at the end of the year. Please mark that on your calendar. The 31st, he will be live on the 31st of December. Sunday morning wake-up call with Dave Toscano. Bob Gibson here with us today from the Weldon Cooper Center as we talk about politics. Bob, you mentioned that the current setup on the Virginia legislature and the House, 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats. One of the issues put forth is that Governor-elect Northam could offer a state position to a Republican to reduce their lead from 51-49. Somebody on the Republican side could take a position somewhere else in the state, give up their role
in the state Senate. That has been discussed. It is still a possibility. Governor Gilmore did that when he took control and helped shift the majority in the General Assembly's houses to the Republican side by taking a state senator from Loudoun and a delegate from Prince William and giving them new jobs. So it's very, very possible that Ralph Northam, who is the governor-elect and lieutenant governor, who knows all the players who've been in Richmond for the past 3 or 4 years, because he's been in the state Senate longer than that, and then as lieutenant governor of the past 4 years, he very, very easily could offer. In fact, one name that has been mentioned many times, and I don't know if this has been decided yet, is Frank Wagner. Frank Wagner is a state senator from Virginia Beach. And Frank is a former candidate for governor in the on the Republican side. He is a longtime member of the state Senate. He very easily could be offered and might accept a position in the Northam administration. And Virginia Beach, which was once a rather solid red locality voting Republican most of the time, could then take his district and send a Democrat, possibly in a special election, to the state Senate.
Is that how that works? You have a special election?
There would have to be, and then the control of the state Senate might shift. They're so close in the House and the Senate right now, we don't know for sure how they're going to line up on January 10th when the General Assembly next convenes.
Let's take a break from state politics and talk about Charlottesville politics. Charlottesville City Council meeting tomorrow night, Monday night?
Yes, they will be considering the Heafy Report, which is a very lengthy and controversial document that outlines the mistakes that were made and some of the things that happened that weren't mistakes during the alt-right rallies that hit Charlottesville over the summer.
Have you, I'm not sure who's had, I guess it's been put out online.
It is. You can read it. You can go online and 207 pages worth of very interesting detail on what the police did and didn't do and what city council did and didn't do and what other officials. The state police and the Charlottesville police and the university police and the county police in Albemarle could have done a better job of coordinating and cooperating with each other. They were not as prepared to coordinate and cooperate and work together on August 11th and 12th as they might have been, and the report points that out rather pointedly.
It's not just about August 11th and 12th, though.
No, it goes back and talks about the Klan rally, which was part of the reason that the police sort of changed their plan after the July KKK rally in Justice Park. We had 30-some members of the Klan who basically paraded for about an hour and were penned in and were outshouted by much larger numbers of counter-protesters. And then the counter-protesters were upset that the police had protected the Klan members, and the counter-protesters were gassed at the end of that, and that changed the relationship of the police to the counter-protesters, and they were not as... the counter-protesters were quite unhappy, and many people in Charlottesville were quite unhappy that the police did not separate the two groups that came together on August 12th.
I wasn't aware that it was going to include anything other than August 11th and 12th until I saw the picture on the front of the report, which is an African-American police officer looking down.
Yep.
And in the background, you can see a member of the Klan in the park behind him.
Right.
And then I thought, wait, that wasn't there on, that's not August 11th and 12th.
That was July. I was there that day. I was about 15 feet from the Klan observing the entire rally.
And I thought, that's an incredibly emotional cover picture to use. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on using that for the cover photo.
I found it representative of what we were talking about in the city at the time. The media was criticized in that instance, actually not because of the job they were doing, but because of the placement they were allowed. They were allowed the space between the Klan and the counter-protesters. So that space was occupied by police, and there were plenty of police there that day in July. Outside the county office building and around the Jackson statue. And there were many, many counter-protesters, and the media occupied the space that the police occupied between the two groups. The police did a good job of separating the two groups on that day. They did not do a good job. Unfortunately, the plan didn't allow them to do a good job when the August 12th Unite the Right, quote-unquote, disturbances took place where the alt-right folks came in and basically in larger numbers with sticks and shields and other weapons challenged people in the street and started charging them, and it just broke down, and the police were not adequately prepared to separate the groups.
There's already been a lot of posting of, you know, various parts of the report online. Some replies from people, Charlottesville police chief replying to what's been put forth for his work, his responsibilities, what he should be held true for.
Well, the police chief at the University of Virginia was criticized in the report. The state police and the city police did not adequately talk about when tear gas was to be used and how it was to be used and how groups were to be managed. They had a plan, but the plan became obsolete, and then they stood by and watched violence for a while before declaring the entire mess a something that had to be dispersed. And then when it was dispersed, people were fighting in the streets.
There's already call for people to resign. In fact, almost everyone to resign. I'm curious as to see. And tomorrow night's city council meeting has been moved from its normal time of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
To 4 p.m. They're going to take care of their regular business meeting at 4 so that they can talk about the HEAFY report at 7. And that's going to be very interesting. Channel 10 will have a large audience tomorrow night.
Not sure that it allows for that many followers. Have you been getting? I mean, what are your thoughts on what's going to happen going forward from this? Do you expect city council to your thoughts on their feedback tomorrow night? Is everybody just going to say I'm sorry?
Well, they've already done that, and they haven't been forgiven yet. There is still a widespread feeling among the residents of the city and the area that problems haven't been solved, that communication hasn't been transparent, that we haven't fixed what went wrong. We had an election, and the election saw two new people elected to city council, and hopefully that will allow some healing, but right now healing has not yet.
But it didn't include neither of the, or certainly Mayor Signer, who I think has received a lot of the blame, whether from the media or from the HEAFY report or from the citizens, wasn't running and wasn't up for
right. He's
re-election.
2 years. He's 2 years into a 4-year term. I don't expect Mayor Signer to be mayor after December. I think we will have a new mayor. I think that will be a chance for the city council to...
Kathy Galvin?
Perhaps. For the city council to start the healing process for real. It's a very difficult time to be on city council right now. When you have one-party control for a long period of time, the party doesn't stay united. The party divides into factions, and city council has been divided into factions of Democrats for a long time. So it's very interesting to see the new council form and see how it handles interpersonal relationships. I hope and trust they can do a better job than has happened over the past year.
Have you heard any changes at UVA in terms of their method of handling this? Because there's already been a request to have a year anniversary meeting here for another alt-right gathering.
Well, the alt-right has promised to come back, but I think the police and the city will be much better prepared the next time the alt-right comes back.
Charlottesville police chief?
You know, Al Thomas, I don't know him. I did listen to him at a meeting at Alvin Edwards Church before the alt-right rally, and he urged people not to attend. He urged counter-protesters to go to other events or to stay away. That was not something that happened. I mean, a lot of people in Charlottesville felt despite the risks, despite the potential for violence, and there was great risk and great potential for violence, we're very lucky that more shots weren't fired and that more people weren't seriously injured. And that's not to say that the injuries and deaths were nothing. They were very, very significant, but it could have been much worse. I think the chief wasn't as well known because he's relatively new. He urged people to stay away. They didn't. They are not going to next time. People in Charlottesville are going to say, we reject neo-Nazis. We reject the alt-right. We are going to show ourselves in the street to be people who are not going to go along with this racist, race-baiting attempt to start a race war in our country.
So if I heard that properly, instead of there being 3,000 people downtown, there'll be 15,000 people, and try and fill the streets so much that they can't even get downtown.
I don't know what numbers might come. I think it will more resemble Boston than August 12th.
1 minute left with Bob Gibson. Bob, what are you looking forward to on the political spectrum?
Change. in Washington and in Richmond. I think we have an opportunity in Virginia to show the nation that we can heal, to show the nation that we are not going to go off the rails in one ideological direction, that we are going to try to work together in a more civil and the ability to meet in the middle is still real. We don't have to devolve into two warring factions, as some in the alt-right might wish.
10 seconds. Do you think that the statue's coming down out of Emancipation?
I think the courts are not going to give the statues a new home. So I think that's a political problem that's going to remain, and Charlottesville has to deal with it.
All right. Bob Gibson here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thank you so much. I hope we can have you back sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Rick.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.